So congratulations, everyone. You've survived another day. It's always fascinating for me when I'm on teaching a retreat and hear different people at the interviews and so on. And here, I was reminded of the fact that there's kind of this one teacher here and 50 or so people listening, which means there's one lot of thing coming out of my mouth, but 50 different things going into the ears. So I always have, it's always a very useful reminder and remember to be as a, when teaching Dhamma is to have that kind of sense of humility, because I don't know what's going on in everybody's minds. I can't teach the right teaching for you, except more or less by accident. So if the peculiarities of your mind happen to be similar to the peculiarities of my mind, then that's good, yeah? It's always, for me, important to bear that in mind and to, for you also, you know, to listen intelligently, to learn intelligently, to remember that not everything I'm saying is sort of issued as absolute truth that has to be followed in all circumstances, and nor is it offered as something which is offered kind of lightly or without reflection. I always remember there was a book written a number of years ago called The Zen Monastic Experience, about an American who practiced with a lot of the different masters, first of all in Thailand, ordained in Thailand as a monk, later on ended up in Korea and practiced and studied with many great meditation masters. And he made this remark in the book. He said that of all the great masters he went to, he said everyone that he went to said, this is the way you should practice and this is how to realize enlightenment. And the only one who didn't say that was Ajahn Mahabua, a Thai forest master. And Ajahn Mahabua said to him, well, these are some things that I've learnt through my years of practice, and you know, all I can do is share them with you, and perhaps you'll find them useful as well. So I always find that to be a, you know, really lovely attitude and a really lovely reminder of the humility which we have to take when we're sharing the Dhamma. So we've spent some time in the last 24 hours developing metta. Some of you will have experienced what that feeling of metta is like to, in one way or another. Some of you will not. That's just the way of things. As we go on during the retreat, I'll teach a little bit more each evening and try to offer a few more tips, a few more things to try out. So just to revise what we went over yesterday very briefly, I said that the important things in developing the metta meditation, firstly, was to, at the start of the meditation, spend a period of maybe 5 to 10 minutes just developing mindful awareness. Following that, We start with the first stage of metta meditation, and within that stage there's a number of steps gradually to build it up. The first one is saying the words, doing loving kindness for oneself, and we say the words, may I be happy. And enunciate and articulate those words clearly to oneself. Second thing is to reflect on the meaning of the words. The third one then is to look for and give rise to that feeling of metta. And of course that's the point which is the most subjective. That's the one which will vary so much between one person to another. Somebody will have no feeling at all. The next person will have an absolutely overwhelming and tears and crying and so on. It's just a natural variation that people have, so don't worry about it. Once the feeling has arisen, the next thing we do while keeping the words of metta there is to try and keep and hold that feeling in the mind, holding it close. And this is as far as we talked yesterday, so far. So what I'd like to talk about this evening is about how to develop that feeling further and to complete that first stage of metta for oneself, and also how to begin loving kindness for a loved person. Now, when we've developed the feeling of metta, and you have that clear and reasonably steady, reasonably present, then to fulfill or to develop that further, we take that feeling and spread it out through all the different parts of the body. The way you do that is very simple. It's just you just gently move the awareness, gently scan your awareness through the different parts of the body. And the feeling, of course, is in your mind. So wherever you put your mind, it'll bring that feeling there. So we move around through the different parts, gradually taking that feeling with us. Until the whole body is saturated through with that feeling of loving kindness. Whole body soaked through. If you're familiar with the Buddha's suttas on meditation, you'll know that he used this kind of saturated imagery very often. For example, he talked about the meditator's body being like a lotus flower, which grows underneath the surface of the water. So that the cool, clear water soaks through every part of that lotus. Or he gave another imagery like the image of a pond, a pool in the mountains. And this pool isn't filled by any streams, and it's not filled by rain, but it's only filled by a welling up of a spring underneath the pond. And so this clean, cool water keeps welling up underneath. And these are all very specific, very carefully chosen images that give a very wonderful idea of what the feelings in meditation are. When we're doing the loving kindness meditation, this is our goal, is to be like that lotus, to be like that mountain pool, with that cool, clear feeling of joy and rapture soaking through the whole body. So the Buddha said that this kind of mindfulness is something we should guard very carefully. The really crucial thing, the most critical thing in this meditation, and actually in all meditations, the most critical thing is, what is the quality of attention that we bring to the meditation? What's the quality of attention? This is really the thing, the most important thing. When we bring that quality of attention is steady and careful, watching, and gentle, attentive, not forcing, not prodding, not squeezing, and not being too lax, but just right. That quality of being just right. And one of the amazing things about meditation is that when you get into the zone, you get into that place where you're actually paying attention in that way that's just right, everything falls into place. Everything clicks without you even knowing about it, there's no effort. Everything comes together. And you realize, actually, this is the meditation. This is what I was supposed to be doing all along. And I've just spent all day doing other things. I've been told to sit and meditate, but actually I'm sitting and thinking about this and that, or sitting and worrying about the pain in my back. And that's not actually the meditation. And that quality of holding that meditation object just right, with just the care, that's what the meditation is. The Buddha gave a very beautiful simile for it. He said it's like holding a bowl of sesame oil, and the bowl of sesame oil is filled up to the brim. Right up to the brim, so that you can't even spill like one drop of it. But that's not all. You don't just hold that. You also have to walk with it. Yeah. So you have to carry it still without spilling even a single drop. Yeah. So that's the care that you have to take. But that's not enough. You don't just carry it in an easy place to carry it. You have to carry it between the crowd and the stage. On the stage is Lady Gaga. Okay. The Buddha didn't actually say Lady Gaga, I just made that bit up, all right? But whoever the 5th century BC equivalent was, that's who's on stage. And the crowd is screaming and yelling and jostling, trying to get to the front. And you've got to walk in between the crowd and the stage, holding that bowl of oil without spilling a single drop. And that's not all. Behind you is a man with an upraised sword. And if you spill one drop, he's going to chop your head off. So that's what the Buddha said. That's how careful you are practicing mindfulness. Yeah? So can you do that? Not easy, is it? Yeah. But it's a challenge. It's a challenge. So again, it's bring to that idea of that quality of attention. They have some lovely similes for that in the Buddhist tradition. One of the similes it uses in the Visuddhimagga, it talks about that if you have a lotus flower which is closed, so each of the petals is resting, they're all nested together, and you get a scalpel. And with the scalpel, you have to cut from the top of one petal. This is actually was a test that they would use for surgeons in ancient India. So before you passed your medical exams, this is one of the tests that they used to give you, and you had to cut from the top of that petal all the way through around to the bottom of it. And you had to cut completely through one petal and not make any mark on the next one inside. Yeah? That's how delicate that you had to be in making that cut. You cut all the way through one petal and not even leaving a small mark on the next one. Yeah? That's how delicate you had to be. So that's given in the Visuddhimagga as like an illustration of that quality of attention, that care, that steadiness, that evenness. And if we bring that quality of attention to the metta meditation, then once the feeling is there, then it will deepen and progress very smoothly. So once we've come to that point in our practice where we've developed the metta, sustained it for a reasonable period of time and been able to spread it throughout the whole body so that it's reasonably even. Yeah? Now, I've spoken with different people during the interviews, and sometimes people have very strong experiences of emotion which will come up like a wave, or like a surge, and then sort of go away. Other people will have a very kind of cool and very peaceful response. Yeah? People have very different kinds of responses. But what we're looking for, the ideal that we're looking for, is something which has a warmth and a presence to it. Yeah? It has a warmth, metta has a warmth and a presence to it. And it has an evenness, it stays there. And it's full through the whole body. So we try to keep that feeling then through the whole body. Now, if we can do that, we keep that and sustain it for, say, 20 minutes or so, then we can consider that to have completed the first stage of the loving-kindness meditation. For those of you who are familiar with the classical Theravadin meditation vocabulary, the state of samadhi at that stage in this particular system is called kanika samadhi, or short-term concentration. And the quality of metta, the feeling of metta at that time, is what we call the ugaha nimitta, the preliminary nimitta or preliminary sign of metta. Now, many of you will be familiar with Ajahn Brahm's teachings, and he talks quite a lot about developing the nimitta in meditation. And normally, of course, in breath meditation, the nimitta manifests itself as a light. Okay, so when the mind becomes clear and concentrated, we see a light. In metta meditation, although the quality of the nimitta is similar, but it manifests more as a feeling rather than as a light. Actually, you can see it as a light as well. It's not an important difference. It's just how you pay attention to it. It's just a question of perception. But mostly it's like a feeling. And so when that feeling of metta is full through your whole body, sustained and even for half an hour or so, this is what we call the preliminary nimitta, the ugaha nimitta. So if you've reached that far in your meditation, then that's very good. Then you will be happy. Your meditation will go smoothly. The hindrances, the coarse hindrances, will be left behind. And it's almost like, even though meditation sort of proceeds gradually, it goes little bit by little bit, but also it does have definite stages. It'll definitely kind of settle into a particular way of being. And when it settles into that stage of metta, stage of loving kindness, you'll feel almost like you're kind of like that. You've moved onto a smooth road. You've been traveling on a rough dirt track, and it's kind of hard driving, and then all of a sudden it's replaced by nice smooth tarmac, yeah, and things will become much easier and much smoother. So when at that time you're ready to start doing metta for the loved person for the second stage. Now, when we're doing loving kindness for a loved person, essentially it's basically the same as we're doing it for ourselves. And especially it's the same in that we don't leave the body. Okay? You stay focused inside your own body. You don't sort of go over there to where that person is. All right? Because that's two. Remember, we're trying to develop one-pointedness of mind, yeah? But if I'm partly here and partly over there, then that's two. I'm in two places altogether already. So keep it inside your body. And people often ask, but do they receive it? Do they actually get your metta if you're just sitting there meditating and you're not sending it over to where they are? Do they actually get the message? So what did the Buddha say? The Buddha says, if there's a matter on which you're doubtful, you should inquire. So ask them. Why not? You say, Mum, how did you feel at 8 o'clock last night? Anything special? And then you'll see, yeah? I personally have this belief that our consciousness is not kind of limited to just this. I think our consciousness is actually much bigger than that, and our consciousness has an energy to it which is much bigger than just the individual, and which I think we're mutually affecting each other all the time. So if we're developing metta, then personally I'm sure that that has some kind of effect. It's probably hard to judge that. But, you know, you do hear various stories about it. One story I heard was about a monk who was travelling from Thailand to America. And this particular monk is a very eccentric monk who's well known both for his meditation and he's also well known for wearing a jacket or a vest which is covered in pockets with zips in it and all kinds of stuff which he carries with him all the time, which partly is religious stuff like amulets and these kinds of things, but also like pliers and scissors and goodness knows what, you know, a screwdriver just in case, you know. You know, like a lot of monks like Ajahn Brahm, they sort of go around and fix things in the monastery or whatever, and he sort of brings his toolkit with him and stuff. And he's well known for doing this. And so one time he was flying to America and he arrived in America, where, of course, you know, these days the security arrangements are very stringent. And he was being greeted by another monk who was there to receive him. And this other monk was amazed because he saw him just walk through the X-ray machine. He just walked straight through it. And nothing went beep. And he said, how did you do that? He said, oh, it's easy. You just spread metta and walk through it. What's the problem? So there's another one you can try out, okay? Maybe next time you're flying, give it a go. So it's not, you know, I personally have faith that these things do have some kind of effect, but I don't know what. I think it's hard to quantify it, and that's not really our concern as meditators. Our concern is to develop our own heart. Yeah. So when we're doing metta for the loved one, we keep our mind just inside the body with that feeling of metta, and you just maintain that. You just put the name of the loved person into the words that you're reciting. Okay, so if I choose my father, I say, may my father be happy, may my father be happy, or whoever I've chosen. And you just keep on going, keep on going, keeping the feeling inside. And you watch and you see whether that feeling changes at all. Because as long as we're differentiating between ourselves and somebody else, then our emotional response to them will change and the feeling of metta will change. Okay? So we'll notice there'll be that slight difference. That's where we're learning. Yeah? Oh, okay. Maybe it's stronger, maybe it's weaker, maybe it has a different tone or something like that. And this is how you learn. Now, there are a few guidelines for choosing who to use as a loved person. First one is that just choose one loved person for each meditation, okay? You can choose different people in, you know, other meditations, that's fine, but you no need to go individually through like every family member and all of these kinds of things. Remember, we want to develop that concentration of mind, so that steadiness. So just one person, one loved person per meditation. Second thing is avoid choosing someone for your loved person who you're likely to have some kind of mixed or complicated emotions for, okay? So we don't want any twisted love-hate relationships here, thank you very much. I taught this in Singapore one time and there was this couple at the front, and as soon as I said that, they both looked at each other. So we want metta is a simple, uncomplicated love. Remember that line in the Metta Sutta, like the love of a mother for her only child. Yeah. So you just imagine that. Imagine a newborn baby and the love that a mother feels for the newborn baby. So it's just that very simple, very childlike love that we're looking for. Doesn't even have to be very strong. Actually, it's not the strength of it that matters. It's the simplicity of it that matters. Okay? So often it's actually better to choose for someone, for your loved person, somebody maybe who you're not so close to. Yeah? Because people that we're very close to, we tend to have complicated relationships with. And somebody who's a little bit more distant, like say a grandparent or nephew or niece or something like that, is sometimes a simpler feeling that we have. Also, we shouldn't choose somebody that we're likely to have a sexual attraction to. Yeah? And also, we shouldn't choose somebody who has died. Okay? Because you never know, they might come and visit you while you're meditating. Or perhaps more likely what's going to happen is that if you choose someone who's died, then, of course, you can have grief coming, yeah? So that grief can cloud that simple loving kindness. So I'm not saying, please don't misunderstand me, I'm not saying that you shouldn't have metta for all these people, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't, you know, deliberately develop metta for them. Please do, but do it at the end of the meditation, or do it when you're doing your chanting. And don't do it actually in the formal meditation itself, because it's in that formal meditation that's when we need to be very refined about how we go about these things, making sure that we don't trip ourselves up, okay? We use this discernment and this wisdom because we want to make it as easy as possible, okay? Once we've learned how to develop the metta and we're skillful with it, then we can forget all of these rules. That doesn't matter, yeah? Develop metta for whoever. But as long as we're still learners, these are useful guidelines which meditators over the years have found helpful. So we choose someone who who is dear to us. Usually best to choose a human being, because other humans we understand better. We have a more direct relationship with, as opposed to animals and so on. Now, when we're developing the metta, the classical sequence, as I've been teaching so far is that you start developing loving kindness for yourself, and then you go on to develop loving kindness for a loved person. And you keep with those two until you feel the feeling is even throughout both of those. If you prefer, if you'd like to, you can swap that around. Start with doing loving kindness for a loved person, develop that until that's strong, and then come back and develop it for yourself. Okay, so that's another way of doing it. Doesn't really matter which way round you do it, but at the end of the day, what matters is that the metta should be even for both, for oneself and for the loved person. That's really the critical thing. Now, what I'd like to talk about just a little bit is some tips for how to get that feeling of metta going. Now, this is something which is very, very subjective and something which I can't really teach, but I can just give a few ideas. Now, if just by doing the meditation as I've been teaching it, if that is enough and you have the feeling of metta coming up and you develop it, then just do that, okay? You don't need to do anything else. But if you're finding that when you're sitting and trying to meditate that you try to get the feeling going and nothing much is happening, your mind feels like there's, you know, just pretty flat. Again, if it's just flat sometimes, again, don't worry about it, yeah? But if it's persistently, you can't get the feeling of metta going, then I'll just give a few skillful means that you can use to help that. One of the simplest ones, is to use memory. And if you use memory skillfully, then that's can be very powerful. We all know that memories can be very emotional. Yeah, they carry a strong emotional charge. So just remember a time when you felt loved or a time when you felt love for somebody else. Yeah? Very simple. For me, I always remember a time, if I try to think of that, one of the first... And again, it doesn't have to be a profound experience. It can be a very simple experience. The important thing is that the important thing is that it's clear for yourself, and that will help to bring that feeling. So when I think about that for myself, and think when was a time when I really felt that very strongly. One of the times that comes to my mind is the time when I was living in Sydney before I was a monk. I was a musician, as I mentioned the other day, and as well as playing in bands and so on, I used to busk a lot on the streets. And I used to often play on the streets in King's Cross and places until all night often. And one time I was really depressed and I didn't really know why. I suppose you don't ever really know why you're depressed. Anyway, I was just kind of felt sad and lonely. And I remember I finished off and I was walking. Normally, at that time I wasn't living in Sydney actually, I was living south of Sydney in Colcliffe, and I used to often when I was staying in Sydney, I used to stay with friends of mine. And I sort of finished up and it was getting towards dawn and I was walking back to go to my friend's house, and then I just thought, oh, I don't want to go there. And then I was just thinking to myself, I just feel awful. I feel like I haven't got anywhere to go. And just this kind of feeling of being lost. And at that time, my father was living not too far away from there. He was living down in Darlinghurst. And, you know, I thought to myself, well, maybe I'll just go and see my dad. And then I thought, no, I couldn't do that. I'm sure he'll be busy. He's going off to work. He doesn't want to see me. Blah, blah, blah. He doesn't have time. And then I thought to myself, that's ridiculous. He's your dad. Of course you can go and see him. So that's what I did. I walked down, and by that time, it was about six or seven or something in the morning, and I see my dad, and just rang the bell, and he just came and gave me this big hug. He could just see that I was really sad. And he didn't ask me any questions, didn't ask me if there were, you know, what the problem was or anything. Just gave me this big hug, brought me up to his place, and had some breakfast and a bit of chat, and then he went off to work. And then it was all okay. I felt all right after that. And so even now, as I'm thinking about that, I can still remember that feeling, a very beautiful feeling, just acceptance and love. So I'm sure most of us have some kind of memory like that, some occasion, some time when you just felt, in a way, there's a feeling of almost being saved by that love and that acceptance. So this is one of the best ways of helping to bring the feeling of metta to mind. When you're having difficulty, another way of doing it, as well as using your own personal memories, is you can just use some other kind of external kind of prop that can help you, like a teddy bear, for example. Actually, normally when I do metta retreats, I always bring a teddy bear along for the retreat, and I just remembered the other day that I didn't have a teddy. So if I'd thought about it, I would have arranged to have one. But it's very inspiring to have a teddy bear at the retreat, because he's the best meditator of everyone. He just sits there the whole time, smiling away, because he doesn't have any issues. He's not thinking about the past and the future. He's not worrying about things. He just sits there. And so when you're sitting in meditation, and it all just seems a little bit too much, then sometimes you can just sort of open your eyes and you see, oh, there's Teddy, he's okay. And then somehow things are a little bit better. So you can use that. Another monk that I know, he keeps some photo in his kuti of like some baby lion cubs. And so whenever he finds it can't get any metta, he gets his photo of these beautiful, cute little baby lion cubs. Or maybe you could get, like, what is it, Nut, the baby polar bear or something like that, and just have some kind of photo or something like that. So it's just another way of helping to bring that feeling of metta. I'm sure you can think of many other methods. It doesn't really matter what. It's just you just kind of play around until you can kind of feel that. Another way you can try is giving up, the creative giving up of meditation. You can admit failure. I can't meditate. I'm hopeless. I'll never be able to feel metta. I'm wasting my time. Look at all these other people here. They're all much better people than I am. I'm so bad, I'll never be able to meditate. So since I've accepted that I can't meditate, well, I've got nothing to lose by giving it a go. And if I can't meditate, maybe I can just pretend to meditate. Because I know that I can't really do it, but if I can pretend, I can just kind of sit here, at least I look like a meditator, and I can't actually do the metta method, but I can pretend to do it, and I can't actually feel joy and happiness, but I can just have pretend joy and happiness. So sometimes if you play around like that, then you can actually feel it, yeah? And actually the feelings can come because you're not taking yourself so seriously anymore. Yeah, that's one of the big problems in meditation generally. I remember one time I was with Ajahn Brahm. We were in Malaysia. We travelled to a new meditation centre. It was a very nice meditation centre that they built there, and they had the kind of the on the wall that said the rules for meditators. And rule number one was meditate seriously. I said, no, that's finished. It's hopeless. No one's ever going to get anywhere in this place. Meditate seriously. I'm a real serious meditator. So no, don't meditate seriously. Meditate playfully. You think about school, right? Remember what happens in school when the kids are being serious? They're sitting in a classroom, falling asleep, mucking around with each other, looking out the window, bored, stiff. At least that's my experience of my school days. I don't know if I can generalize to everyone else. And then the bell goes, yeah, and it's time to play. Everyone wakes up, yeah, full of energy, yeah. You run into the playground and like running a million miles around an hour doing stuff, yeah. It's astonishing, isn't it? Yeah. So that's that playful energy, yeah. But what's also interesting about play, like again, if you watch that. Like kids on a playground or whatever, it's not just chaos, yeah? Kids actually get together and play games, don't they? And the games have rules and they follow various procedures and things like that. So it's not like a chaotic energy, but that playful energy, it really sparks something. So if you're trying to bring that playful energy, that creative side into the meditation, rather than just sort of by rote trying to get all the method right, then often that can have a much better result as well. So again, these are just a few tips for you to help if you're having problems getting the metta going. One other thing that I've mentioned to a few people in the interviews, I can't remember if I've mentioned in the talks, but don't try to do the metta meditation every time you sit during the retreat, okay? And in fact, just do it when you feel good. Actually, I talked about this yesterday, didn't I? Yeah, so just do the metta meditation at the times when you feel good. The rest of the time, just do the breath meditation or vipassana or whatever it is that you're used to doing. Okay, so in a few minutes we'll do some guided meditation, but just before we do that, are there any questions specifically on the things that I've talked about so far? We can have some more general questions later on, but anything specifically that's unclear or that you want some more explanation about what we've talked about so far? Yeah. Oh, look, if it works, just try it, yeah, and see how it goes. Yeah. You know, maybe try doing it for the animal for a while and then try doing it for a loved person and see if there's any difference there. Yeah. My only reservation, I don't think there's any problem with that at all, but my only reservation is because in doing this method, we want to make it as even as we can between the different stages. And so whether that fact, if the loved ones and the animal, whether that's going to make it a bit less easy to make that even across the different stages. That's the only thing that I'm thinking about, because I've never done that personally, so I can't speak from my own experience. But you know, just try it out and see what happens for yourself. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good question. There's no need to visualize. Just the name of the person is enough to provoke the emotional reaction. Okay, so that's for example, I can just say the words John Howard, and that's going to provoke an emotional reaction among many people. Huh? Yeah. What will happen is sometimes of course the face or the image of that person will come up spontaneously, yeah, which is fine, that's not a problem. But as long as you just remember that the basic focus is the feeling, so don't get distracted by the feeling. Sorry, don't get distracted from the feeling. Yeah. Okay, so let's do some guided meditation for the next 20 minutes or so. So sitting quietly, not running off to the past, not running up to the future, just being settled and still here in the present moment. And leaving the mind focused in the heart. Say to oneself the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. articulating the words clearly and distinctly, evenly and steadily. Making a firm, smooth foundation for the mind. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Reminding oneself of the meaning of those words. That deep, pure, wholesome wish for our own true happiness and well-being. May I be happy. May I be happy. looking deep inside the heart. See if you can see something more subtle than the words of metta, and that's the feeling of metta. Soft, gentle feeling of loving kindness is radiating warm glow in the heart. When you notice that feeling, hold that gently in the mind, keeping the feeling safe, keeping it close. And as the feeling of metta becomes more steady and present, gently move the focus of attention around the body, bringing the feeling of metta into each part of the body. If you come to any place that's painful or resistant, some place that doesn't want the metta to go there, just leave that aside. Go around it and spread metta to all the easy places. Until your whole body is soaked through with loving kindness. From the top of the head to the soles of the feet, from the hairs on the skin to the marrow of the bones. Now moving to the second stage of metta, keeping the mind just as it is, not moving or changing the mind at all, and just introducing the name of that loved person into the words of metta. So if I choose my father, then may my father be happy. May my father be happy. May my father be happy. Or whoever it is that you've chosen for that loved one. May they be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. Keeping the feeling of metta flowing, even, settled within the whole body. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. Now coming near the end of the meditation, from that loved one back to oneself, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy, letting the words of metta go, letting the feeling of metta fade away, and allowing the mind to return to a neutral space, empty, open and clear. And before we finish, taking a minute to review over the meditation, inquiring into cause and effect. What just happened? How did I use my mind? How did my mind change during the course of that meditation? What was useful? What was obstructive? And what does my mind feel like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so question time. I think I've got some new written ones here, but feel free to ask. Oh, actually, most of these are, I think, the same as yesterday's. So I think we've only got one new question. Should get rid of those. Okay. So here we go. It's a long one. Okay, so question. So today, apparently, a lady asked the Dalai Lama a question. So someone has been to see the Dalai Lama today. How was it, by the way? A mysterious questioner, if they're here. No. She said her son asked her, if God created Jesus and everybody, who created God? That's the kind of question that kids ask, isn't it? God created everyone, then who created God? The Dalai Lama answered that God could not be proved or disproved by science, and we should think of the question of God as a mystery. I remember years ago Venerable Kanipalo saying that there was a Buddhist sutta which explained how God and the belief in God comes about. Could you briefly explain this sutta sometime that's appropriate? Okay. So now's the time. I don't know if now's the time that's appropriate. So is God a mystery? Well, you know, they asked Martin Luther that, you know, the great Protestant reformer. He was asked, what was God doing all the time before he created the world? And his answer, he came back very quickly and said, God was sitting in a birch tree forest, making long rods with which to hit people who asked impertinent questions. So there's a number of Buddhist suttas that talk about how God came to be. I mean, I must admit, I think I would disagree with the Dalai Lama's position there. I personally think that it's possible to take a stronger stance on that. I know he's trying to be diplomatic. I for a long time have believed straightforwardly that God doesn't exist, in the sense that he's believed by Christians and other theists, and I believe that's also the Buddhist point of view. But the particular discourse and the passage which talks about how God and the belief of God comes about, essentially is a story or a parable which talks about how, because in Buddhist cosmology, of course, you have many different levels of beings, okay, from the human realm and animal realm and ghosts and, you know, all these different kinds of realms. And one of the highest level of realms is what they call the Brahma realm. Brahma realm beings are produced in the, reborn in the Brahma realm because they practice jhana in this lifetime. So as a human, you practice deep meditation, samadhi, you really purify your mind, and you get reborn in the Brahma realms. That is, if you haven't developed insight. So beings are produced in the Brahma realm, and according to this story or this parable, some beings which are reborn in the Brahma realm stay there for long, 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 long time. And they stay there for so long that they forget that they were ever born anywhere else. And so because of that, they come to the illusion that they're eternal. So they have this deluded view. And actually that kind of view corresponds very well with the kind of view that people can have in meditation. So when you meditate, you can actually come to states of mind. If you come to states of deep samadhi, and it feels like you've come in contact with something eternal, because it's so, the state of concentration is so steady, it doesn't change. And normally we measure time by change. So when time is still, when nothing changes, it feels like it's eternal. But of course it's still conditioned and it still comes to an end. So according to this sutta, this being, this deity, comes to this mistaken view that they're eternal and that they've produced everything, that they're the father, the creator of all, the maker of all beings, and so on and so forth. And then later on, some other beings get reborn in that realm, and because they see this particular being has been there before them, they also take him as being eternal. And so this is how that kind of mistaken view arises. So it's important to notice that the distinctive difference here from the Buddhist point of view, Buddhism never had any problem with the idea that there can be beings that are born that are very long-lived, that are very powerful, that are very good, that are very knowledgeable. But it doesn't accept that you can have a being born that lives forever. You can't have a being that's all-powerful. You can't have a being that knows everything. Yeah, and these things, according to Buddhist philosophy, are not possible, both because they're... there's no way of proving them, but also, more importantly, that the notions themselves are incoherent and don't make sense if you start to think of them through logically, as that boy was asking the question, if God created everything, who created God? So these, once you start to follow these questions through, you always end up with very profound logical and philosophical problems.
Says not necessarily the truth. I mean, you have to try and understand.
I wasn't trying to say that that sutta was proving anything. Yeah. So the question was just that is there a Buddhist story that talks about it? So that's the story that talks about it. You're quite right. The story itself doesn't prove anything. What were you going to say?
I've heard many Buddhists say that they leave the door slightly open to the possibility of there at least being a mystery outside of the mind that can't really be explained. It's just a mystery. Maybe it's better to keep it like that. Just because the Buddha said nothing's eternal, that doesn't really mean that nothing's eternal.
Sure, yeah, yeah. But, I mean, there's more to it than that, yeah? It's not just that the Buddha said that, but that there's also no... for myself, I'm first and foremost, in terms of my own understanding of things, I'm an empiricist. And as someone who's empiricist, what that means is I rely on what can be known and what can be inferred from what's known. And I think this is also the approach that the Buddha taught. And the simple fact is that there's nothing knowable that lasts forever. And there's not anything which is even knowable in principle that lasts forever. So, again, I can only speak from my own point of view. There are many things, of course, about life which are unknown, and there are many things about which we should be humble about. One of them, for example, the Buddha said, is the first creation of things, yeah, whether there's a first creation of everything. The Buddha said this is unknowable. He didn't make any statement about it. But there are other things, I think, which we can make reasonable statements about. For myself, as I said, for many years, the idea of a theistic idea of a personal God, which is omniscient, omnipotent, morally perfect, creator of the world, I personally think that you can take a stronger position than agnosticism about that. I think it's an incoherent notion. I think it's incompatible with the existence of evil in the world. And personally, I think there's almost no chance that something like that could exist. But again, that's just my point of view.
Yeah. I think people are very capable of more evil.
I would disagree with that. Yeah, empirically, again, as an empiricist, I think I disagree with that. I don't find any evidence that people who are atheists are less moral than people who are theists. And in fact, there was a study done on that a couple of years ago, which systematically compared moral conduct of religious and non-religious regions. And the study was mainly done in Europe and the States. And they compared, say, for example, the Scandinavian states, which are relatively secular and relatively low degree of religious belief, with, say, places like Spain and Greece and so on, with a much higher degree of religious belief. And similarly in the US, they compared the northern states, which tend to be more secular, with the southern states, which are more religious. And they used a variety, or they compared a large variety of moral conduct over and a large number of surveys and studies. Things like, for example, teenage pregnancy, drug addiction, abortion rates, murder rates, violent crime, all of these kinds of things. And they found that consistently the rates of all of those things, or virtually all of them, were lower in the secular areas where there was less religious belief than there was in the religious areas.
I think you're talking about Christianity, which is not the only idea of God. Because most of these places in America are very Christian, and maybe some of the other places you're talking about as well, Christianity.
Yes, but don't overstate what I was saying. You said earlier that you believe that if people don't believe in something greater than themselves, that they behave in immoral ways. And I responded to that by saying that actually, as far as I've seen evidence which has been done, then actually doesn't support that. And if anything, can be read as indicating the other way. So of course there can be other evidence, and of course that's not complete. I wasn't trying to say that. I was merely saying that, as far as I've seen it, that the evidence doesn't support the idea that if you don't believe in something greater than yourself, that you're going to be less moral as a person. Yeah?
So it's a completely different...
Yeah, sure.
I just wanted, in the sutta, the Metta Sutta,
yeah,
said something about responsibilities.
Uh-huh.
Duties.
Yes. Apakicho, yeah. It just means that when you're very busy, you get stressed and you get annoyed, don't you? Well, I do anyway, speaking personally, yeah. So this is one of the things if we want to develop metta meditation. And it's very relevant these days because, you see, people actually work so hard, don't they? I think it's because of all the labour-saving devices we've got. You know, the bushmen in the Kalahari Desert, you know, living in the harshest environment in the world, they would work for 20 hours a week, average. Yeah, that's how long it takes them to actually get in the harshest environment of the world with virtually no technology. That's how long it takes them to supply everything they need as opposed to all the things we want, right? So these days we work so hard, and Australians actually, despite our image as being, you know, very relaxed and easygoing, actually Australians are among the hardest working people in the world. For some reason, I don't know quite what went wrong there, but we are. And so when you work a lot, you tend to get stressed, and you don't have that time to break, you don't have the time to relax. It makes it harder to develop metta, yeah. Oh dear. That's probably a bit too much to go into right now. I'll talk more about the different states of meditation during the retreat, okay, so later on. But just generally, as you're meditating, you know, we start out meditating with our ordinary everyday mind, the mind as it is here and now, yeah? As we practice, the mind gradually becomes more and more purified. And so how the mind is, how we're aware, what the state of the mind changes. And particularly as the level of concentration of the mind becomes stronger, that those states of mind become more, they become more regular or predictable. They become more simple, so that we can sort of say that it's one state rather than, so the mind is not so chaotic. Yeah, so normally a mind is quite chaotic, different thoughts and different feelings and so on are coming, but in deeper meditation the mind's more steady and stable. So that's what we talk about, the states of mind in meditation. I think there was a question over here. Yeah, John. Oh, it's because if you eat dessert all the time, it's not so good, nice. Yeah, so you want something salty in between, and then you'll really appreciate it. Yeah. You can if you like. You know, again, it's not an absolute rule. It's just a guideline. It tends to be that when you have that break and that change, your mind feels a bit more refreshed and kind of it wants to do it again. If you keep doing the same thing all the time, your mind tends to get a bit stale. Yeah. That's all. Yeah.
I don't know if this is skipping a few stages or if it's relevant at all, but what about the practice of metta without an object? Without a person or someone or to be loving towards just a state of loving kindness?
Yeah. What you'll tend to find if you just do metta without, you know, without having anyone to do it for and so on, usually, you know, if you do that, if you just have a nice feeling, it'll stay there, but it won't deepen. It'll just be a nice feeling for a while, and then it'll go away. So that's the point of the meditation method, is to give a structure which can help us to actually deepen it. Because each, and I'm going to talk more about this in the future talks, but each aspect of the method is developing a specific aspect of samadhi, or a specific aspect of the concentration of mind that we're aiming for. So all of those will come together and work together. Was there another question over here? Did I miss earlier? No. Yeah. All right. You sure? Okay. So any other questions for this evening? Okay, so let's finish by paying respects.